Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the September 26, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week shows the American flag in the shape of the United States. It's on kind of an old parchment paper background. There are cuts all through the middle of it. The edges are burning. It's in rough shape. The headline is "A Nation Torn. Can Democracy Survive Political Violence?" And that comes up several times, including our first main story. Charlie Kirk's alleged killer charged with murder. What happened? Utah prosecutors said this week they would seek the death penalty for the accused assassin of conservative activist Charlie Kirk, saying the 22-year-old suspect told his transgender partner that he'd murdered the right-wing star because I had enough of his hatred. The 31-year-old Kirk, a podcaster, leader of the youth mobilization group Turning Point USA, and fierce critic of trans rights, was killed by a single rifle shot fired from a nearby rooftop as he spoke to a crowd of thousands at Utah Valley University. After a 33-hour manhunt, authorities arrested Tyler Robinson, 22, whose parents recognized their son in a surveillance images and persuaded him to surrender. A former straight-A student raised by Republican parents in St. George, Utah, Robinson had grown up more pro-gay and trans rights oriented over the past year, his mother told police. He was in a romantic relationship with a roommate who was transitioning from male to female, to whom he allegedly confessed after the shooting, saying, "Some hate can't be negotiated out." Robinson has not cooperated with authorities and stayed mute during a court appearance, except to confirm his name. But a picture of him has emerged through interviews with family and friends. A college dropout studying to be an electrical apprentice, he was described by friends as squeaky clean, considerate, and highly intelligent, but socially awkward. He was a hardcore video gamer who spent long hours online, immersed in what Utah Governor Spencer Cox called the deep, dark internet. President Trump, a friend of Kirk's, called him a martyr for truth and freedom and ordered that flags at federal buildings be flown at half-mast. Democratic officials unanimously condemned the murder. California Governor Gavin Newsom, who'd recently hosted Kirk on his own podcast, called it disgusting, vile, and reprehensible. While evidence suggests Robinson acted alone, Trump pinned the blame on the radical left, as did some GOP lawmakers. "Y'all caused this," Representative Anna Paulina Luna, Republican from Florida, yelled at Democrats on the House floor. In a televised speech, Kirk's wife, Erica, the mother of his two young children, vowed to continue her husband's work, saying, "The cries of this widow will echo around the world like a battle cry." What the columnist said: "Kirk's assassination is another horrifying scene in a country that is heartsick of witnessing them," said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. "In just over a year, we've seen two assassination attempts on Trump: the murder of United Healthcare CEO on a Manhattan street, the firebombing of Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro's home, and the shooting of two Democratic state lawmakers in Minnesota, one of them fatally. We now stand at a dangerous moment. In our hyper-partisan era, each side portrays the other as not merely misguided, but out to destroy the country. To some, it's just a partisan game, but disturbed listeners are less capable of separating rhetoric from reality." The left seems incapable of dealing with reality, said Jeffrey Blahar in National Review. In the hours before Robinson was caught, it was to be expected that desperate progressives would claim, in defiance of the known evidence, such as shell casings etched with messages including, "Hey, fascist, catch," that the killer was a disgruntled member of Kirk's own tribe. But I was stunned as the real picture emerged, and the hysterical spin and assertions of blunt unreality mounted from leftist influencers, insistent that murderous hatred could come only from the MAGA fever swamp. Instead of engaging in willful blindness, progressives must own the truth, said Andrew Egger in the Bulwark. Kirk was widely reviled on the left for his toxic rhetoric on minorities and LGBTQ people, and an angry trans advocate killed him for it. To try to spin it any other way is to mirror the MAGA cultists who blame the January 6, 2021 insurrection on Antifa plants. To confront political violence, we must recognize how far the problem has spread and to whom. Ideology aside, Robinson raises a pressing question, said Alicia Finley in the Wall Street Journal. How did a high school whiz kid devolve into an assassin? To answer it, we must look at the endless hours Robinson, who inscribes shell casings with obscure online memes, notices bulges, OWO, what's this, and references to video games spent steeped in a dark digital world. Plagued by loneliness and alienation, too many young men turn to games and social media platforms that become substitutes for real-world camaraderie and can lead men down dark holes. Robinson's spiral recalls that of Luigi Mangione, charged with assassinating UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, who also retreated into a digital wilderness amid mental health struggles. America has survived political tumult before, said Jonathan Freeland in The Guardian, but these are different times. Previous presidents rushed to condemn political violence and called for calm and unity, but Trump is throwing fuel on the fire, calling for retribution against the left, even as he ignores or encourages right-wing violence. This week, while listing victims of political violence, he pointedly failed to mention a single Democrat. And when Paul Pelosi, the husband of then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, was bludgeoned in his home in 2022, Trump made repeated jokes instead of condemning the attack. Political violence is not random, said Barbara Walter in Politico. History shows it blossoms under certain conditions, one being political leaders who tolerate or encourage it. It also takes root when democracy is declining rapidly. Societies are divided by race, religion, or ethnicity, and people have ready access to guns. The U.S. checks all four boxes, and the outlook for improvement on any front is bleak. It all points toward things getting worse, not better. The controversy of the week. Charlie Kirk, the legacy of a culture warrior. Whether you shared his beliefs or found them abhorrent, no one can deny that Charlie Kirk changed American politics, said John Brabender in the Wall Street Journal. Most concretely, there is Turning Point USA, the conservative youth outreach group Kirk founded at 18 after dropping out of college. Kirk, who was assassinated last week at age 31, grew into a sprawling network with chapters on 3,500 high school and college campuses and more than 250,000 members. TPUSA's Get Out the Vote efforts in key swing states arguably helped tip the 2024 election to Donald Trump, said Ian Ward in Politico. In 2020, nearly two-thirds of voters 18 to 29 cast a ballot for Joe Biden. Last year, Trump lost the demographic to Kamala Harris by only 4 percentage points and won a majority of young men. Post-election, Kirk served a dizzying array of functions within the broader Trumpian universe. A frequent guest at Mar-a-Lago and the White House, Kirk advised Trump personally on policy and personnel decisions, and he used his vast social media and podcast empire to fill the void left by traditional party messaging, positioning his multimillion-dollar political machine as the one-stop replacement for GOP institutions President Trump had dynamited. But Kirk's impact went far deeper than that, said Andrew O'Hare in Salon. He came of age politically in the Obama years, when Democrats not only held the White House, but also ruled Hollywood and seemingly all of mainstream culture. The multiracial left's supremacy over the fatally unhip GOP felt permanent, but the relentlessly cheerful Kirk spotted an opening to sell conservatism to the young as a cool, rebellious alternative to an overconfident liberal hegemony obsessed with ideological purity. Kirk's edgy brand led him too often into provocateur territory, said Ezra Klein in the New York Times, but he practiced the politics of persuasion in exactly the right way. Kirk went to liberal-dominated campuses across the U.S. and debated all comers, which is what he was doing when the assassin opened fire. Liberals could use more of his moxie and fearlessness. Such eulogies to Kirk's civility are hard to square with his record, said Ta-Nehisi Coates in Vanity Fair. Kirk reveled in open bigotry, with regular rants about black crime, Mohammedans, the freaks of the LGBTQ community, and, of course, the sinister Jewish donors funding it all. When a hammer-wielding home invader attacked then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband in 2022, a grinning Kirk joked that a patriot should bail out the assailant. None of this justifies his murder, but if that murder has us denouncing political violence and dehumanizing rhetoric, let's recall that Kirk himself wanted Joe Biden executed for crimes against America. Kirk was not a saint, said Paul D. Miller in the Dispatch. He was an entrepreneur, a debater, and a partisan who volunteered to be chief cheerleader to a demagogue, and he excelled at his job. He was also an institution builder and a man of courage. In an era of partisan isolation, he embraced free speech and told Americans to talk to others, not to fear disagreement, and to share ideas. The best way to honor Kirk's complicated legacy is to keep arguing, and the best way to oppose Kirk's legacy is to keep arguing. Without arguments, democracy dies, and so will many more people. For that reason, if no other, even Kirk's greatest critics and opponents should agree. Je suis, Charlie. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It's a good week for tattletales. After an Australian reporter asked President Trump if it's appropriate that his family has accumulated so much wealth during his second administration, and Trump responded that, "Your leader is coming over to see me very soon. I'm going to tell them about you. You set a very bad tone," added Trump. Quiet. It's a good week for koalas after Australian regulators approved a new vaccine to protect the marsupials from chlamydia, the sexually transmitted disease. Peter Timms, a microbiologist who helped develop the shot, said chlamydia currently accounts for as much as half of all wild koala deaths. It's a good week for youth outreach. After Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. at a vigil for the late Charlie Kirk claimed that he first met the conservative activists in July of 2001 and that their friendship blossomed over the following years. Skeptics noted that Kirk would have been 7 in July 2001. But it was a bad week for the pro-life movement. After Fox News host Brian Kilmeade said on air that homeless people with mental health issues should be given an involuntary lethal injection or something. Just kill him. The Fox and Friends star later apologized for what he called an extremely callous remark. It's a bad week for stolen moments. After an anesthetist admitted to a British medical tribunal that he abandoned a patient on the table mid-surgery to go have sex with a nurse in an adjoining operating theater. It was quite shameful, to say the least, said Dr. Suhail Anjum. I have only myself to blame. Finally, it was a bad week for fair play. After several competitors at the World Stone Skimming Championships in Scotland were disqualified for using what organizer Kyle Matthews called suspiciously circular stones. Matthews says the offenders subsequently apologized for their nefarious deeds and confessed to having shaped the stones with a mechanical grinder. And in other news, EPA proposes eliminating greenhouse emissions reports. The Environmental Protection Agency last week proposed ending a program requiring businesses to report greenhouse gas emissions in the Trump administration's latest attack on climate regulations. Since 2010, the Greenhouse Gas Reporting Program has required more than 8,000 facilities, including power plants, steel mills, and oil refineries, to detail their emissions, allowing the government to track the climate impact of major facilities. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin called the program nothing more than bureaucratic red tape that does nothing to improve air quality, and said cutting it would save businesses up to $2.4 billion. Scientists and environmentalists insist the data is critical for helping the country lower emissions and address climate change. The Trump administration is taking steps to roll back dozens of environmental regulations and to withdraw from the global Paris Climate Agreement. The title of this week's briefing is Tilting at Windmills. President Trump has long loathed wind power. Now his administration is trying to kill the industry. Why does Trump hate wind power? His animus toward wind turbines, which he calls windmills, dates to 2011 when the Scottish government announced plans to build an 11-turbine wind farm about a mile out to sea from Trump's luxury Aberdeenshire golf course. The big, ugly structures, Trump said, will ruin the view for golfers and lead to the almost total destruction of Scotland's tourism industry. He lost his legal battle against the project, the blades of which are now barely visible from his course, but acquired an abiding hatred of wind turbines. Trump has since claimed, without evidence, that their whirring noise causes cancer and leads people in Wales to go crazy, and that their blades are killing all the birds. A 2020 study found that collisions with turbines do kill about 200,000 birds a year in the U.S., but that's far fewer than the 599 million that die in collisions with buildings and the 2.4 billion killed by cats. Still, after returning to the White House in January, Trump almost immediately went on the offensive against the industry, which provides about 10% of all U.S. power. We're not going to do the wind thing, said Trump. Are wind farms being shut down? The Interior Department last month issued stop work orders for Revolution Wind, a $4 billion, 65-turbine wind farm set to power more than 350,000 homes in Rhode Island and Connecticut next year. Construction is 80% complete, but the White House, without elaborating, ordered the pause on national security grounds. Kirk Lippold, a retired U.S. Navy commander and renewables advocate, said it's abundantly clear this administration is using the guise of national security in order to eliminate all the green energy sources it can. Connecticut, Rhode Island, and the companies behind Revolution Wind are suing over the stoppage. The administration last week asked a court to cancel the 2024 approval of a wind farm off Maryland and is also reconsidering the approval of farms in Massachusetts and Rhode Island. The three projects combined would power nearly 2.5 million homes. Meanwhile, the White House has launched a legislative and multi-agency campaign that could scuttle the development of many future projects. What does that campaign look like? On his first day in office, Trump signed an executive memo temporarily blocking new or renewed wind energy leases on the Outer Continental Shelf, an offshore area about twice the size of California, and ordered a review of how federal leases and permits are granted for offshore and onshore wind farms. The Republican tax and spending megabill that Trump signed into law this summer ends the Biden-era 30% tax credit for new wind and solar power projects, unless those projects start construction by July 4, 2026, or complete construction by the end of 2027. Separately, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy last month canceled or withdrew $679 million in federal funding for marine terminal and port improvements designed to support the offshore wind industry, saying wasteful wind projects were using money that should go toward revitalizing America's maritime industry. The administration is also proposing new regulations that would make it difficult for wind power projects to get off the ground. What kind of regulations? Duffy wants a 1.2-mile property setback for wind turbines near highways and railroads and has asked the Federal Aviation Administration to thoroughly evaluate wind turbines to ensure they do not pose a danger to aviation. And despite relaxing similar rules for the oil and gas industry, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum is seeking to revoke a permitting policy that lets wind farms incidentally take or kill a number of eagles during normal operations, so long as they try to reduce raptor deaths. Burgum, who says turbines are unreliable because you don't know when the wind's going to blow, has also pushed regulators to deny permits for wind and solar projects on federal lands unless they can generate as much energy per acre as coal, gas, or nuclear plant in the same location, a test they are certain to fail. Burgum said policy was needed to protect the environment and wildlife. Will these policies affect Americans? They will, because the grid desperately needs new power sources to satisfy surging demand from electricity-hungry AI data centers, as well as from homes and industry. Electricity prices for U.S. households jumped more than twice as fast as the overall cost of living last year. Research suggests the elimination of clean energy tax credits could add $400 to annual energy bills in the Upper Great Plains and $130 in Pennsylvania. American workers will also pay a price. More than 17,000 jobs are connected to offshore wind projects that have already been canceled or put on hold, or could be shut down by the Trump administration. Sidelining wind will also have a negative consequence for the climate by keeping the U.S. reliant on coal and gas plants that pump out planet-warming emissions. Can the wind industry survive in the U.S.? It's not certain. Even if some anti-wind policies are struck down in court, the moves will chill anyone with limited capital from seeking federal approval for a wind farm, said Eric Schlenker Goodrich, head of the Western Environmental Law Center. It's possible Trump could let some paused projects go ahead. A stop work order on New York's $5 billion offshore Empire wind farm was lifted this spring after New York Governor Kathy Hochul agreed to revive a blocked natural gas pipeline, according to administration officials. Hochul denies making such a deal. While Trump's crackdown may set the industry back years, some wind power advocates say the president won't be able to kill the sector entirely because the country desperately needs the power it generates. This hurts a little bit, said Chris Mickelson, executive director of the Port of Humboldt Bay in California, which lost $427 million in federal wind funding. But an administration can't change the fact that the U.S. has incredible energy demands. Republicans for wind. Trump's anti-wind stance puts him at odds with many residents of GOP-run states. Texas is now the nation's top wind producer. It generates 28% of all U.S. wind energy, more than twice as much as second-place Iowa, and gets about 22% of its own energy from wind. Yet some Republican lawmakers in the gas and oil-producing state want to topple the turbines. This summer, Republican state lawmakers tried to pass three bills that would have made it harder to install and operate wind turbines and other renewable power sources, even on private land. All three cleared the state Senate before dying in the lower chamber. The bills infuriated John Davis, a rancher, Trump supporter, and former state legislator. He has seven turbines on his land, which provide about 40% of his income. "It's a hard life out here. There's rocks, mesquite, and coyotes, and not a lot else," he said. "If there's anything to make life easier, do it." Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll take two from the U.S. "When Abusing Teen Girls Was No Scandal." If the Jeffrey Epstein birthday book shocks you, you've forgotten how our culture once normalized the sexual exploitation of pubescent girls, said Rebecca Solnit. The collection of birthday letters to the deceased sex offender Epstein from 2003 is a relic from a time before feminism and Me Too changed public acceptance of the widespread exploitation of girls and women. The book included a supposedly funny drawing showing Epstein grooming young girls with candy and then later being sexually serviced by them as he lies naked on a beach chair. Before feminism, the objectification of teen and even tween girls was everywhere. The 1970s produced films like Woody Allen's Manhattan, in which a creepy 40-something dated a teenager, and Taxi Driver with 12-year-old Jodie Foster playing a prostitute. Rock stars routinely had sex with 15 and even 13-year-old girls. It was only after feminism empowered women that we learned to insist that we were people endowed with rights, that sex without active consent was rape, and that minors could not legally consent to sex with powerful adult predators. Until feminism changed society, Epstein's exploitation of teen girls was, as Donald Trump wrote in his birthday card, a wonderful secret. The steep cost of not vaccinating. "Vaccines save lives," said Donald G. McNeil Jr., "but they also save money. In fact, tens of billions in healthcare dollars every year. Take the flu shot. It doesn't always spare people from the ever-mutating viruses, aches, and pains, but it keeps people out of the hospital and the morgue. That's why health insurance companies make it free. It's better to pay a pharmacy $100 or so to inoculate a 70-year-old than it is to spend tens of thousands of dollars for that senior to spend a week in intensive care with pneumonia. The dirt-cheap measles vaccine recently saved Texas from potentially enormous economic damage. The state's outbreak of a reported 762 measles cases, which included 99 hospitalizations, was primarily limited to the non-vaccinated. Imagine the Texas-sized hole that would have been blown in the state's health care budget if Texas had never used the measles vaccine and suddenly one-eighth of the population had to be hospitalized. If the anti-vaxxer health secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., succeeds in his mission to undermine all vaccines, He will not only unleash a public health crisis, but a national financial disaster. This column comes from the United Kingdom. A hairdresser kidnapped by ICE. During my 7 years living in the U.S., I never even had so much as a parking ticket, said Lee Stinton. Yet I was grabbed by Donald Trump's immigration police and held for a month in vile conditions. An ICE agent stopped me on a Florida street in June while I was on my way to work at a hair salon. "You look Mexican," he sneered. "I am not," I replied. "I am from Northern Ireland." But that didn't matter. I was now caught up in the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. Federal agents crammed me and about 100 others into a cell built for 10 at Chrome Detention Center in Miami, where there was one toilet and barely fed us. They had a doctor surgically remove my subdermal piercings without my consent while I was shackled to the bed. And when the pain meds wore off during the procedure, they just laughed at me. Everything was done to intimidate and torture. One man who had been begging for his heart medication for days literally dropped dead from a heart attack in front of my eyes, a sight that haunts me to this day. Finally, they deported me on the excuse that I had once overstayed a visa in 2018, even though I was, at the time of my arrest, in the process of getting a green card. The whole experience was the most inhumane thing ever to happen to me. The last word, our feature story, my shipwreck story. On my first time out as a commercial fisherman, said Alec Friedman in the Atlantic, my boat sank, my captain died, and I was left adrift in the Pacific. This is what happened next. The life raft was small but sheltered, like a kiddie pool but sturdier, and with a camping tent on top. The sides shuddered in the wind and rain, but I felt relatively safe inside. Certain that rescue was coming, and exhausted by shock, I fell asleep. When I awoke, the storm was still raging. I opened the flap for a moment and saw the sun low in the sky. I didn't know how much time had passed since I'd fallen asleep, maybe an hour, maybe an entire night. I needed to find some way to situate myself in this strange new reality, and began by taking inventory. I had the clothes on my back, wool cap, flannel shirt, pants, boots, and a sweater, a Christmas gift from my grandmother. I had my phone, destroyed, and my wallet. On the raft, I found a collapsible oar, a first aid kit, a small fishing kit, two emergency blankets, an assortment of signals, four hand flares, three rocket flares, and three cans of orange smoke. I had food, a box of maybe a dozen emergency rations, which looked like beige bars of soap and tasted like oily shortbread, and 2 liters worth of drinking water in individual packages. The oar was useless in the rough seas, and I had no clue which way to row. I immediately wasted 2 flares, firing them into the air in the deluded hope that an approaching rescuer would see them. In the fishing kit was a razor blade intended for filleting a hooked fish, though it seemed to invite another use. I thought of throwing it overboard, but instead stashed it away. I tried not to worry. Getting a helicopter airborne probably took a little time, especially in a storm. Worst case, if our mayday hadn't been heard, someone would figure out the captain and I were missing and come looking. I didn't worry at first about my food or water running out. I just had to wait. My first 3 or 4 days on the raft, the sky was so dark with storm clouds that I could barely see the sun move from east to west. With nothing to mark the hours, each day felt like it contained far more than 24. I remembered reading about Franciscan monks and how they ordered their days around work and prayer, and I decided I needed to devise my own routine, starting with a regular lookout. Every morning, and then periodically throughout the day, I unzipped the flap that kept the wind and water out of the raft and checked to see if anything was out there, land or a boat or a plane. I bailed out water and wiped off the condensation that had accumulated inside the raft from my breath. I removed my clothes, one piece at a time, and hung them up on an interior bar of the shelter to dry, though they never fully did. I added new tasks when the need arose, such as blowing into a valve to reinflate the raft when it began to sag, and organizing and reorganizing my water, food, and flares. Tossed by the waves, I could never sleep more than an hour or two at a time. I hadn't been dry, not completely, since I'd fallen into the ocean. Soon the emergency blankets were worn to shreds. The silver foil deteriorated, exposing a sharp plastic mesh that cut into my waterlogged fingers. I tossed the scraps overboard, and from then on I used the dry bag, a small rubber rucksack, as a blanket. It was hardly bigger than a pillowcase, but by ripping one of its seams and pulling my knees tight against my chest and my arms against my sides, I was able to cover myself nearly up to my collarbone. Desperate for any bit of warmth, I ignored the cramping discomfort it caused. I prayed often, always aloud, at first pleas for rescue. Over and over I asked God to save me, not my soul, but my physical self. After days of praying the same prayer, I tried offering God something in return. First, I apologized for every past transgression I could remember. Any injustice or sin I feared I may have committed, I tried to atone for, so God would listen to my prayers. I used what I could recall of the Ten Commandments to accuse myself. I hadn't honored the Sabbath in years. I had lied, I had coveted, I had stolen. Worst of all, I hadn't honored my father and mother. I saw my first ship after 5 or maybe 6 days of drifting. I launched a flare into the sky. The ship was so close, I had no doubt the crew would spot me. I could see the containers it was carrying. The company's name, Hapag Lloyd, was painted on the side. As the rocket arced through the air, I imagined being lifted up out of the ocean. Someone would give me dry clothes and a hot meal, and they'd let me call my mom and dad on a satellite phone. I'd tell my parents what happened and that I was all right. Then the ship would drop me off at its next port of call, and I'd fly back to California, and my life would return to normal. A happy, beautiful normal. But as the flare rose and fell and was extinguished in the ocean, the ship kept going. Soon it disappeared over the horizon. I'd been rationing my water, never consuming more than the equivalent of a small glass every 24 hours. But by the end of my first week on the raft, I knew that my distress signal would never be answered, that the emergency positioning beacon had failed to transmit. I was alone, and I was terribly thirsty. What sense was there in suffering if all it meant was postponing the inevitable? I drank as much as I could stomach and closed my eyes. The next morning I saw that no water was left. I had strange, vivid dreams. Then I didn't dream at all so much as hallucinate. As my eyes would begin to close, I'd hear splashing, like the breaching of a school of big fish. And then suddenly I'd feel that the raft was being propelled forward, as if on a tow line over the surface of the water. But every morning I always seemed to be in the same place, at the center of jumbled swells, rising, falling, sometimes breaking. One night I dreamed that the life raft had washed ashore on the bank of a pond. I stepped into the reeds and then onto a road that led me to a small house. My friend Jack was sitting on the porch. He waved. He had been expecting me, but I was embarrassed. My clothes were wet and dirty, my hair tangled, my face covered with a patchy beard. I made an excuse. I told him my car had broken down and I was on my way into town to get a screwdriver. I'd be a little late for our appointment. "Don't worry, take your time," Jack told me. "Take all the time you need." I walked back to the pond, climbed into the life raft, and fell asleep. When I woke up for real, I opened the flap and found myself once again, still, in the middle of the ocean. Even when I was awake, I had experiences that I couldn't explain. One day, I sensed that I wasn't alone in the life raft. I couldn't see a figure or hear a voice, but I knew they were there, and I knew their name. It was IOB. I said to myself, IOB? Was I losing my mind? I laughed at myself. Only a sane person would be able to laugh at himself, right? But I couldn't shake the thought of the IOB, and I didn't want to. The IOB brought me a sense of peace I hadn't ever felt on the life raft. It wasn't great company, it was silent and invisible after all, but for the first time I felt like something, someone, was there to witness my continued existence, my choice to stay alive. I had often thought that if I died and my body was never recovered, no one would ever know how desperately I had clung to life, how I'd fought to live, even when despair felt absolute and overpowering. My parents would know. My friends wouldn't know, but the IOB knew. By now, I'd lost track of time completely. The sea grew calm. One night, before the last of the clouds cleared, I was able to collect some rainwater to drink. It tasted cold and sweet. I even managed to catch a small fish. I bled it with the razor blade and ate it to the bone. I threw the line back in the water, but didn't catch another. Sometimes I could see land on the horizon, and I tried to row toward it, counting my strokes into the hundreds, the thousands, but I never made it any closer. I'd seen maybe 5 or 6 ships by then, but most so far off that they looked like two-dimensional paper cutouts pasted on the horizon. I wasted my last rocket on them and lit the hand flares and popped canisters of thick orange smoke. For days, I prayed that God would send more ships, but each time one passed and didn't stop, I was left so bereft, so gutted by the brush with hope, that I began to feel I would rather never see another. Now I had only one flare left. Holding on to it felt like holding on to life itself. With the clearing of the storm, the temperature had dropped. During the day, the sun hitting the side of the raft was enough to keep me warm. But when night came, the cold set into my damp clothes and skin, and I shivered so violently I couldn't sleep. I was out of food, out of water. I knew I would not survive much longer, but even as my hope for rescue began to evaporate, so did my despair. I was going to die. I didn't look forward to it. I wanted to see my mom and dad again, my brother and sister, my friends. I fantasized about the smallest, most mundane things. Waking up in bed, getting in my car, waiting at a red light, grabbing coffee, working. But the idea of getting off the raft was becoming a distant hope, like winning the lottery. It would be really nice if it happened, but I didn't expect it to, and I wasn't going to tear myself up about it. The peace I had known to look for found me. Where before I'd dreaded sunsets, the precursors to cold nights and strange dreams, and the mark of yet another day lost to the raft, now they were only sunsets. Sometimes I found them beautiful. Yet another freezing, trembling night. At last the sun rose, its light hit the side of the life raft, and I could feel it warming up, as if someone had lit a wood stove in the corner. Maybe now I could finally get some sleep. I pulled my hat down over my eyes and tried to let myself doze off, but I couldn't. I couldn't neglect my morning ritual, the first duties of my watch. I compromised with myself. I would do the morning lookout and then get to sleep. When I crawled across the raft and opened the flap, I saw it immediately. A boat, close enough that it actually looked real and coming closer. I turned to get the flare, which I'd wedged into a corner. I hesitated. This was my last one. Before I lit it, I began to scream at the very top of my lungs. I screamed until I felt as if my lungs were imploding and kept going. When the boat was as close as it was going to get, I finally lit the flare. The flame burned to the base, and when it reached my hand, I dropped the flare in the water, where the hot, burning metals cooled and groaned. I kept screaming, waving my hands over my head. I looked and sounded like a madman. When at last I ran out of breath, I fell silent. And in the silence, I heard someone answer me. "We see you. We're coming. We see you." I watched the boat change its course toward me, and the crew lowered a ladder and helped me aboard. The captain cooked me warm food, and a deckhand gave me dry clothes. I ate and cried and thanked them. It turned out that I'd drifted far from the harbor. The land I'd seen over the horizon was Vancouver Island, some 150 miles away from where the voyage had begun. The captain said he'd seen life rafts on the ocean before, but they'd always been empty. He asked me how long I'd been on the raft. I asked him for the date. It had been 13 days. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in The Atlantic. We'll read a couple of the health and science short pieces today. Rover finds possible traces of Martian life. Evidence is mounting that Mars may have once had microbial life. Scientists said last year that they suspected a potential biosignature in certain speckled stones, dubbed leopard spots, discovered by NASA's Perseverance rover. A detailed new study of those rocks shows that they contain the minerals vivianite and greigite, typically produced by microbes. The findings are really compelling, geoscientist Joel Hurwitz, a member of the Perseverance science team, tells the New York Times. On Earth, these would be examples of microbially influenced environments, where the microbes are consuming the organic matter and making these minerals as a byproduct. Perseverance landed in the Jezero crater in 2021 specifically to search for such evidence of ancient Martian life because the site is a former river delta and lake bed. The presence of the minerals isn't definitive proof of life. Greigite can also be produced by certain very hot chemical reactions. Still, said Hurwitz, within the sort of limitations of our rover payload capabilities, these samples don't look like they've been cooked. The researchers hope to gain clarity if the samples can be brought back to Earth to be more closely examined. The Mars sample return project was put on hold last year, though, after the cost estimate rose to $11 billion and President Trump's budget request this year would cancel it entirely. How bison restore the grasslands. North America was once home to tens of millions of bison, which roamed from modern-day Nevada to the Atlantic in herds so vast that the Lakota people measured them by how many days they took to pass by. Today, fewer than 400,000 remain, most in small static herds, and only one migratory population still exists, in Yellowstone National Park. A new study has highlighted the crucial role that herds play in the ecosystem, reports the New York Times. Yellowstone's 5,000 bison travel more than 1,000 miles a year, grazing back and forth along a 50-mile corridor in the park. The researchers found that far from overgrazing, the bison enriched the land. By eating some of the grass and quickly moving on, they boosted microbial activity and nitrogen in the soil, improving plant nutrition for other animals by up to 150%. Lands where bison graze freely shows far greater biodiversity and faster regrowth than fenced pasture. Conservationists are now discussing whether it would be wise to remove some of the park's border fences and allow the bison to wander beyond Yellowstone. Buffalo helped shape this continent, said Troy Heinert, a member of the Rosebud Sioux tribe who is chief of the bison management for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And the more buffalo that are out there, the ecosystems are improved for all the other animals as well. And we'll read one of the Talking Points articles. Cancel culture now coming from the right. MAGA's doxing war has begun, said Edith Olmstead in the New Republic. Hundreds of Americans have been fired, suspended, or investigated over social media posts expressing negative opinions about Charlie Kirk after the prominent Trump ally's assassination last week. Vice President J.D. Vance encouraged the purge, saying, "When you see someone celebrating Charlie's murder, call them out. And hell, call their employer." But many of those being canceled didn't celebrate Kirk's death. Instead, they called out his history of making racist, misogynist, and homophobic remarks. One Oklahoma teacher was investigated for writing, "Charlie Kirk died the same way he lived, bringing out the worst in people." Washington Post columnist Karen Ataya was fired for post lamenting the country's gun culture and reminding her audience that Kirk had said black women like Michelle Obama and Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson don't have the brain processing power to succeed without affirmative action. A website called Expose Charlie's Murderers received over 63,000 tips about people deemed to be celebrating Kirk's death. "I've long opposed cancel culture," said Charles C.W. Cook in National Review, "but there's a chasm between cheering someone's death and offering a political opinion. Some people did express happiness that Kirk had been assassinated, which is a rejection of the classically liberal order atop which the United States has been painstakingly built. Those individuals should suffer the consequences of endorsing murder. If you're pleased a man died because you dislike his words, you're a useless citizen of the Republic." Conservatives spent years rightly complaining about the excesses of leftist cancel culture, said River Page in the Free Press. In recent years, the left started a cultural revolution aiming to make it socially unacceptable to disagree with them. Now the right is doing precisely the same thing. Seemingly innocent people are getting swept up, like the manager of a Texas roadhouse in Florida who was fired because his wife allegedly called Kirk a Nazi. Cancel culture is the attempt to bully everyone into accepting one faction's cultural preferences, said Nick Cotagio in the Dispatch. The MAGA right now is canceling people for arguing Kirk was a bad influence on American politics, not a secular saint, which offends MAGA's right-wing cultural hegemony. These so-called conservatives never wanted an America where people don't get canceled. They want an America where they get to do the canceling. Now, they've got it. And a few of the short notes. Grocery prices rose 0.6% from July to August, the largest monthly increase in nearly 3 years, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Almost every major grocery category is now more expensive than a year ago. Fruits and vegetables are up 2.3% year over year, and beef steaks 16.6%, with analysts citing Trump's tariffs and shortages of farm workers as contributing factors. There have been at least 47 school shootings in the U.S. so far this year, leaving at least 19 people dead and 77 others wounded. School shootings have climbed sharply in recent years, rising from 44 in 2018 to more than 80 in 2022, 23, and 24. From 2008 to 2015, no year saw more than 40 school shootings, and 4 years saw fewer than 20. International air travel in the U.S. is down 7% from 2024, according to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection data. Canadian tourism has been especially hard hit, dropping 25% this year. Over the past 5 decades, the share of House Republicans who attended an elite university dropped from 40% to 15%, while the percentage of similarly educated GOP senators fell from 55% to 35%. The number of elite educated Democrats has climbed slightly. In the 2021-22 Congress, about 40% of the party's representatives and 50% of its senators had graduated from a top school. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from novelist Frederick Forsyth, quoted in The Knowledge. He says, "Almost all great fortunes are based upon one cracking good idea and the guts to go with it." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.